This panel discussion at the 10th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference put on by the Migration Policy Institute and other organizers focuses on the state of play, insights from the field, and Washington on the immigration reform debate. Moderated by Doris Meisner, the director of MPI's U.S. Immigration Policy Program, the panelists include Roy Beck, president of Numbers USA, Bruce Morrison, who chaired the U.S. Immigration Subcommittee and now chairs Morrison Public Affairs Group, Lorella Praley, who is Director of Advocacy and Policy at United We Dream, and journalists Fawn Johnson with National Journal and Ryan Lizza with The New Yorker. Here's Doris Meisner.
Good morning. Thanks for being with us. My name is Doris Meisner, and for those of you who have been at this conference before, you will know that it is our tradition to have the first panel after the keynote be a panel that we call the State of Play. Now, the State of Play tends to be very different each year, but the point of the State of Play panel is to pull together a group of key players and analysts. They tend to be different every year, to look at what's different and new and significant in the world of immigration law, policy, and politics. In particular, this time, we are going to focus on politics and issues surrounding the politics of immigration. And so we have gathered a panel of people that are actors and players in very different realms across the spectrum to look, as I say, at what's new. And what's new this year is a lot. I mean, we had a presidential election last fall that put immigration back on the legislative agenda for the first time in 5-6 years. We had a bipartisan group of senators come together to press for a comprehensive bill, and they actually passed in the Senate in June a huge, big, ambitious bill. Since then, of course, the spotlight has been on the House and on action or inaction in the House, where immigration reform is continuously pronounced to be dead and continuously wrong in that pronouncement. I think Mark Twain had some kind of a good quote on that topic, but it pertains even as we speak. So there's a lot to talk about and a lot to parse. And that's what we'll try to do a bit of this morning. Now, we're going to try to cover a lot of ground. We're going to try to cover it as quickly as possible, more from the standpoint of getting issues and ideas out than probing them to any length. But we're also going to leave 15, 20 minutes for questions from the floor, if we can possibly do so. And we're going to use a conversational format, so I'm not going to do formal introductions of the speakers. I'll say something about them as we do the first round of questions, but I'm going to do a first round of questions and then hope that that will take us into a discussion and into some follow-ups from me and among us. So with that, let me start. I'm going to start with Lorella, who is the advocacy director for United We Dream. And I'm going to start by asking you, Lorella, as somebody that's been absolutely in the center of the Dream movement, you and your advocacy have been absolutely one of the really new developments in the immigration realm, particularly since the last legislative debate that we had. And you've been successful in achieving one of the real big victories for pro-reform, interests, and that has been the DACA program. So tell us how you accomplished it, and tell us what it teaches us, and you, if anything, about broader immigration reform.
Thank you, Doris. Good morning, everyone. So I think it would be unfair to not talk about 2001 and the 2000s, but we don't really have a lot of time. I think it's important to say that really this movement of this Dream movement is born around 2001. You know, you have the first Dream Act that's introduced, but I really think defining moments for our movement are in the mid-2000s, when Dreamers begin to come out, when there was no such thing as a Dreamer, when people use everything but their real name when they were coming out. And I think it was because of the courage of those people and their commitment to build a real movement that they inspired people like me to defy fear and confront power in order to build power. Now, if you fast forward to 2010, I think that's a key year for our movement and also a key defining moment again for what became the DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. 2010, we fall 5 votes short in the Senate of passing the DREAM Act. But it was a year where we had our first largest national mobilization and began to have more coming outs, more people coming out as undocumented and unafraid. And we really popped in the media. This is the year when dreamers make it into mainstream, when we're really talking not only to members of Congress and to advocates in DC, but when we're talking to the broader American public, right? And you begin to create a national profile about what it means to be undocumented in this country, having come here at a very young age for some of us. I came here when I was 10. And being in this kind of legal, being in this limbo, at any moment we could get picked up. The truth on the ground and the facts were that dreamers were getting deported, that deportation levels and records went up tremendously once the Obama administration came into office. And so it was in 2010 that we realized that there was not really a lot of legislative appetite for a fight for DREAM in 2011. But we were seeing the moral crisis in our community, and that was that dreamers were getting deported. So it's at this moment that we kind of do a political assessment of what's possible. And that's when we begin to really develop the idea of administrative relief. Given that it's probably a fact that Congress will not act or move on legislation, on DREAM legislation, are there other options available? And it was a fascinating moment for our movement because we had just come out of this defeat, right? And just in a matter of 5 minutes after coming out of the Senate vote, you see dreamers recommit themselves to this fight and decide that in 2011, in 2012, we had to get a win for our community. And what would it take to get something not legislative? What is our end goal? Our end goal was to really stop the deportation of dreamers. So if that was the case, it required that we map out what power looked like. Where was power? Who held up who influenced who? And we decided to choose on focusing on 30 stories. We were going to look at 30 dreamers who were in removal proceedings in the year of 2011, and we were going to create massive communications campaign around their cases. And it was all tied to the Obama administration. Obama is deporting dreamers. We made t-shirts that said Obama deports dreamers, right? So we began to develop this multi-pronged strategy, really, that allowed us to continue to build a national profile, but to really also expose the moral dilemma in our community. And so that included the 30 cases of what we called education, not deportation cases, in often strategic places for us. It also meant developing a congressional strategy. Who could reach out to the administration? Who could make a case for dreamers? It also meant, you know, a lot of pressure on the Obama administration. And I can't say this enough, showing up at events, you know, telling him, yes, you can. You can do more than you say that you can do. And really our leverage was that he was deporting dreamers. Our leverage was that in 2008, the president had campaigned on immigration reform to get the Latino vote. And instead of passing immigration reform, we were seeing mass deportations of members of our community. It was also meant polarization, right? So in 2012, you have Mitt Romney and you have President Obama up against each other. And you begin to create opportunities for Mitt Romney to sound very extreme, right? But you begin to make the DREAM Act and dreamers an issue throughout that campaign. And you do the same with President Obama. He's not doing anything. He's not delivering. It also meant being nonpartisan. And so if people remember in 2012, Senator Rubio comes out and says, I want to work on a bill. You know, it has to do with dreamers. It's going to address the legal status of dreamers. And everyone, I think, was expecting for United We Dream and the broader immigrant youth community to come out and just bash it right away. And we said, we don't have to do that. What opportunities does this present for us in order for us to get administrative relief? And so we started to have a talk and a dance with Senator Rubio, right? And we had a similar dance with the administration. And then I also think that there were other key actors. We had legal scholars who wrote a letter and clarified the president's executive authority and what he could do when we asked about administrative relief for Dreamers. So it was really building and leveraging the moral authority that we had built over the years, making that pop into American consciousness and taking advantage of the situation. 2012 was also an election year. What was Obama going to do to deliver on his promise to the Latino community? And I think really our leverage and our story from day one was the fact that the president was deporting people. So I think that it's a long history, it's a long story, but it comes from what it meant to build a movement. What it meant to get young people, train young people, inspire young people to come out, really when it wasn't safe to come out and to begin sharing their stories. And what was really important for us was actually putting a face to the issue. People talk about illegal immigration and immigration reform and the Dream Act, and they don't really know who they're talking about. So it's easy to stand here and say, you know, real triggers must be met before we can legalize people. Otherwise, they can just go back to being undocumented or remain undocumented. It's a lot harder to say that when you know who you're talking about. It's a lot harder to say that when you have 2 million dreamers that come to mind. It's a lot harder to say that when you see the faces and the work that our parents do. And so for us, it was about that. We had no other power except for our moral authority, right? And really our ability to defy fear and to come out.
All right. Thanks very much. That's one mobilization story. So I want to turn now to a different kind of mobilization and ask you, Roy Beck, on behalf of Numbers USA, good morning. You've been in this world for quite some while, and particularly in the last legislative debate, 2006 and 2007. Your organization was credited with effectively stopping legislation, largely by flooding congressional offices with emails and phone calls. And we haven't seen that this time around. So why is that? What's happened, particularly during the August recess when many people expected it? Could you talk to us about your mobilization in behalf of your point of view and what is different and what tactics you're using?
Well, you didn't see something that really happened. We actually had far more activism this time than we did in 2007. I think that maybe what you're referring to is some reports about rallies, something that which basically our kind of side of the issue has never done much of. But we had hundreds of thousands of phone calls that have gone into Congress this year that we've paid for. In terms of people using our phone lines, millions of email and fax contacts. During the August break, our people were at over 450 town hall meetings of 147 of the Congress people. 95% of them were our targets. August went very well for us, and I think this fall is an example of how well it went. We'd already started in July, but we spent August doing our best. What we do is connect individual citizens with their members of Congress and their staffs. We spent those 2 months, July and August, trying to inform those staffs and congressmen, especially Republican House members who really hold the power on this now, of two key points of the Senate bill that our internal polling had shown the American public hated. Governor Barber put his finger on one of them, and that is the idea that work permits, basically lifetime work permits, would be given in the first year with only promises of enforcement afterwards. Our polling showed that overwhelmingly, and it's not just our polling, just about every form of polling has found this, that Americans want to see full implementation of E-Verify entry-exit system, the border security, before work permits are given out. A legalization and a deferral of deportation is a different issue, but in terms of actually moving millions of illegal aliens into the legal workforce, American public really hate that idea until full enforcement has happened. So we've really used our members. We have over 2.5 million people who are in our network now to put that across. The second thing that was really has not been stated much in the media is that the aspect that there would be work permits given to over 30 million foreign citizens during the first 10 years. Now, our analysis says 33 million. The CBO analysis says 28 million. Center for American Progress said 32.5 million. So let's just say 28 to 33 million. It's like moving the entire population of Canada into the United States over the next 10 years. Now, not every single one of them will work. Some of them are young, but they will eventually turn 18. But it's around 30 million people added to the legal workforce. Our polling found that is something that most of the American public didn't know. Frankly, most of the members of Congress weren't focusing on. So those two aspects of our mobilization, we feel like were very effective and helped really solidify the Republican conference in the House against providing a majority that would allow any bill to come to the floor, out of fear that any bill that came to the floor would result in this massive increase in work permits at a time that we have 20 million Americans who are U6 unemployed. That is, they want a full-time job, they can't find one. Either can find no job or they're forced into part-time work. And we leveraged that particular thing. The aspect of high unemployment was, of course, the thing that is, I would say, has been the most important in stalling any passage of bills this year.
Well, okay, so employers and employment and the issues of employment are key in this. You're talking about them in one way. Governor Barbour talked about them in quite a different way. Bruce, I'm going to ask you to talk about them from the standpoint of being the most seasoned player here.
Oldest, you mean.
In this group. Well, we can have a contest on that, but anyway. Not only have you been intimately involved in employer issues and interests in your recent work, you also, of course, chaired the Immigration Subcommittee in the House the last time we really did pass a serious immigration law in 1990. So could you talk to us about how employers are being represented in the various elements of their interests in this current debate, and give us any kind of comparisons that you might be able to draw on from your earlier experiences with employer interests? How similar is it? How different is it?
Glad to be here, Doris, and I compete with you anytime for being the most experienced. I think we've both been around this issue for a long time, and I hope we've been constructive in our contributions. I certainly know you have. The first to be said, I don't represent any employers. I represent I do represent nursing employers, but my general work in this area has also included employees in terms of the IEEE USA, who are engineers who have a perspective on immigration. So I wouldn't necessarily be selected by employer groups to be an employer spokesman.
True, but you watch it all very
I do.
Close.
So I just want to, that's just an important caveat, because some of the things I say will not be necessarily what some employers would say. The first thing to be said from a historical perspective is in the 1980s and 1990, when there was the last major a response to a problem of large numbers of people here illegally and concerns about how our legal immigration system worked, it was a very different world. And it was a far more collegial, bipartisan world, which is not to say it was not partisan. but it was a much less polarized world. And if any of you would like a taste of that, former Speaker of the House Tom Foley passed away very recently, and there was a memorial service for him this week. And Bob Michael, who was the Republican leader when he was Speaker, gave a statement. And I'm sure it's available online. If you want to know how things were different, you should read it, because it's quite instructive about the difference between partisanship and polarization. And that's a lot of what's going, the difference that's going on now. Is it in today's Post? In any case, it was a dramatic statement. And Republicans who sat near me said he really did us proud. And I say that just to say that the environment in which we're trying to get things done is different from that environment. And it causes polarization on both sides of the issue, not just on one side of the issue. And that becomes a problem. The other thing that is different about where we are now from where we were is that in the 1980s, we tackled the issue of legalization first before we tried to correct all the things that were wrong with the legal immigration system. And I think that helped us get the legalization process, the legalization legislation done, and then we were able to move on and do other things. The holding hostage of one goal for another, I think, is a continuing problem, and it tends to confuse the priorities. So I think that was one of the reasons we succeeded. The situation with what employers were asking for, what they do ask for, has also changed in a way that I find very disturbing. In 1990, we had a focal point in our reforms. One of them was to focus on increasing skilled immigration. Another was to make sure when we increased immigration, we worried about the impact on Native workers explicitly. And third, that we controlled against the use of temporary employment permits as opposed to green cards. Nobody has ever called America the nation of guest workers. Yet, if you listen to what people ask for today and what people support today in the name of immigration, an awful lot of it is guest workers. And that's a euphemism itself. So I think that that's a big change and a big concern. And whether it is work that Americans won't do depends a lot on what the conditions of the work are. So we shouldn't just think that every problem we have in terms of the workforce is a problem of we need more numbers, as opposed to we need to do something about the situation. I think we were more focused on that and able to come to a bipartisan accommodation on that in 1990 more than what's going on today. The 1990 Immigration Act was the first immigration act in the history of the country that both the Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO supported. So obviously, either we just cut the difference just right, or we did engage people with different perspectives in something that was a resolution. We also were very focused in 1986 on creating employer sanctions for the first time, because we understood, as some in the debate seem not yet to understand, that all of the talk about the border really is often beside the point if we don't focus on what happens at the workplace. And that's really where the work needs to be done. And you can't get enforcement at the workplace, which I like to call prevention rather than enforcement. You can't get that at the workplace if you do not deal with the illegal population, because 7 million people are in the workforce, and if you're going to go in and say you can't work unless you're authorized, you have to face that question. Those two things have to be tied together, and they are tied together certainly in the Senate bill, but they're also tied together with a lot of other things that maybe is baggage that ought not to be there if one wants to focus on the critical question, legalization and prevention of future flows that are illegal. I don't think anybody disagrees with that goal. But you have to approach it sensibly, and you can't approach it just by throwing money at the border, just by having an entry-exit system, or by forgetting that when Doris was commissioner, the Clinton administration did more work on the border than had ever been done in the history of the country. But during those 5 years from 1995 to 2000, when we had a huge economic boom, we had more entries without inspection than ever before. And why was that? That was because of the jobs magnet. So if you ignore the jobs magnet, and frankly, the Bipartisan Policy Center didn't say one thing about employment verification in their statement, you're just missing the whole story. So if we're serious about that, we have to focus on that. Finally, the last thing I would say is, there are, you know, Roy talked about things Roy and I could get into lots of debates, but the one place that I think he is right and people who are in the immigration advocacy community need to focus on is it's not irrelevant. Numbers are not irrelevant to what happens to American workers and what kind of competition there is for jobs and whether or not wages rise above levels that you can't support a family. Those are real issues, and immigration advocates need to not put them aside and think that's not an issue. I don't think immigration advocates think that way, but sometimes their advocacy sounds that way. Thanks very much.
Okay, there are lots of things there to follow up on, but I'm going to go through the rest of the speakers first, and then we'll come back on follow-ups. Because I want to turn now from the mobilizing to the sheer mechanics as well as broad politics of this issue, and go next to you, Fawn. And by the way, I'm not doing formal introductions of people because you all have their bios. And so I'm turning to Fawn, who, of course, reports for the National Journal. And so you're a student of Congress. You watch it closely. And you've been following this journey of immigration reform on a daily basis. So, you know, the most recent really pivotal event that has to do with the House, of course, is the coming out on the other side of the shutdown and the debt ceiling crisis. And that, of course, goes to the issue of leadership in the House and the issues within the Republican Party. Talk to us, if you would, about how you see the House right now with immigration reform being talked about again as an area where possibly they can come to some agreement as compared to what's been the case in recent weeks. Is the Speaker emboldened at this point to be able to take more risks? Is he likely to be even more cautious based on what's come before? And what about the members that were in opposition?
Right.
Will they dig in further, or will there be an atmosphere of looking for something where there can be agreement?
Will there be healing is what you're asking?
You can use whatever words you choose.
Those are really excellent questions. And I guess my observation to start with is to say that I have written multiple times to the great despair of many immigration advocates that I think immigration is dead in the House. That doesn't mean that the issue has gone away. It is something that my editors routinely keep on telling me to move away from, and then I keep coming back to because everyone is asking about it. When I talk to Republican strategists, when I talk to people who are either pro or anti in the Republican Party, the issue always comes up. So I just want to be clear that when people say immigration is dead, what they mean, that means different things. It might mean that the House will not pass it this year. I think that's highly likely. It might mean that the House will not pass something next year. I also think that's highly likely. But it doesn't mean that people aren't thinking about the issue. They actually think about it very much. And I know that the Republicans are very worried about it because they, as much as, and the governor really laid this out very clearly, as much as the House is very safe and anything that they do on immigration, the Republican Party is only going to invite grief to them, they are aware of the broader implications of appearing to be so dug in on the issue. And I think they would really like to go forward with it. But let's keep in mind where we started. A couple of weeks ago, it was at the brink of default that the Speaker, John Boehner, finally said, okay, I have done my best for the people who are protesting how this government is funded, and now I'm going to turn to the Democrats, and we are going to reopen the government, and we are not going to cascade into a global default, which I think all of us were very happy about. That's where they are. And I think the Speaker was emboldened by that in the sense that he, you know, he did exactly what he was supposed to do. He stood by his guys, and then in the end, he said, "All right, we're done with this. We're not going to risk anything." What I have been told by members of the House Republicans, some of them who are well into leadership, is that they see the healing happening through the budget, not necessarily through immigration. And you saw this yesterday when the budget committee convened for their opening conference. They have been very clear that they are looking for the smallest deal possible. And when I'm talking small, I'm talking really small, like maybe funding the government for another year. And that's where I see the healing happening. What members have said is, once we fix this budget problem, then we can turn to immigration. And since I've been watching them try and fix the budget problem for 3 years, since the Tea Party essentially took over the House, I don't see that happening anytime soon. So that's just kind of the situation that we see it. In answer to the question about the Republicans who really don't want to see an immigration bill happen, they are going to dig in farther. I will say, I've asked Roy this question. I've also asked Steve King this question. How many are there? And they will not answer that question. But so I'm going to say there's probably 24, right? Or I don't know. He's not even nodding. See? He won't even tell me. I do believe, though, that there are enough Republicans to stop any legislation from going through the House that does not have Democrats' support. And there is the problem in terms of them actually acting. And the Speaker just needs to focus on it, and he's focusing on other things right now. I'll come back to that later, but I'll let Ryan give his trenchant political analysis.
Okay, all right. Thanks very much. Okay, so to Ryan Leza, who works for The New Yorker and looks at the big political trends and the big shifts in what's going on in the country, and, of course, one of those big facts or realities about immigration is that our overall polling results consistently over the years increasingly show public support for the kind of an immigration bill or the elements of an immigration bill that were enacted by the Senate, and particularly the sticky wicket issue of illegalization tends to be polling in the low 70 percentiles where public support is concerned. So why this difference with what it is that Fawn has just described, but more fully, what really are the complexities of the opposition that makes it really so difficult to create the connection between what is more and more accepted in public opinion as compared within our politics and our Congress?
How much time do we have? first of all, thank you for having me. I was just looking, and I noticed that some of you are already tweeting the event. And for the person who said that I look like Clark Kent, that's actually just a Halloween costume. I think it might be helpful for me to just sort of back up a little bit and explain how this issue has played out basically in the last year. This sort of we're back to where we were pre-2012 essentially, right? The immigration reform, the idea in the White House was that elections actually mean something in a democracy, and if you run on an issue, then you get to institute your agenda. And obviously that was a very naive thing for Obama to believe, because that actually doesn't really happen in our system. And their view was that when the election was over, Republicans would look at the results and look at the demographic trends in the country that led to Barack Obama's reelection, and they would reach the rational conclusion that immigration reform is an issue that they need to put behind them, and that Republicans would find a way to support some version of this legislation, right? And demographics really were the driving explanation of Obama's victory. Mitt Romney, if you look at the percentage of the white vote that he won, it was the percentage that he sort of hit his goals, right? He put together a demographic coalition that previous Republican candidates used to win the presidency. Only this time, it wasn't enough. And so Barack Obama was the first president, or the first person to be elected or to win with the percentage of the white vote that he received, which was, I think was under 40%. The RNC immediately looks at this problem, right? And they do this self-assessment and put out an extremely interesting report, right? The DNC and the RNC never, ever admit that anything is wrong with their respective parties. Like, they exist to tell us that everything is great and they are on the cusp of glorious victory. The RNC did something under Reince previous, it did something amazing. They put out this, you know, the Growth and Opportunity Project report, which is just dozens of pages of material about why the RNC, why Republicans are doomed. And they also did something very interesting, or doomed unless they do X, Y, and Z. And one of the chief recommendations in that report, also something that party committees never do, right? Party committees exist to help candidates win elections. They're really not there to advise them about policy. But in that report, the party said Republicans should pass comprehensive immigration reform, right? And they used those words. CIR means something to people in this community. They actually said pass comprehensive immigration reform. So that was a huge, huge turning point in the period right after the election, going into the holidays last year. And Democrats, of course, in the Senate are led by Chuck Schumer, are looking for some very conservative, what Chuck Schumer described to me as Tea Party Republicans, that they can join hands with to get this bill passed. And who steps up but Marco Rubio, who, if you remember, in 2010, when he won his election, he was one of the main leading lights of this new generation of very conservative Republicans. And he joins forces in this Gang of Eight, this coalition, to push immigration reform. Now, he'll tell you he didn't do that for political reasons. He didn't do that to help the Republican Party win a larger share of the Hispanic vote. But nevertheless, he takes a risk. He looks at what the RNC is saying, what some of the previously very conservative pundits are saying. You had people like Sean Hannity, and whose views on immigration reform moderated in the immediate aftermath of the 2012 election. And so there was this whole movement, whole moment in the Republican Party where they were coming to a sort of cooperative relationship with the Democrats on this issue for a whole host of reasons. And that all seems to slowly grind to a halt as the Gang of Eight negotiates their bill in the Senate and as the bill approaches the Senate floor over the summer. And I think there was this sort of slow, bubbling opposition just beneath the surface that was gathering momentum. And by the time they actually had a bill put together, and like all comprehensive legislation, it is a product of deals, and sometimes the deals don't look so great on closer inspection. And you just saw this sort of grassroots populist campaign through June and July move against this legislation. And, you know, I think in the last go round in 2007, a lot of Democrats and a lot of liberals would accuse Republicans of opposing the legislation because they were anti-immigrant. And I don't know, maybe that is still part of the opposition, but certainly the big divide now in the Republican Party is not just you can't caricature this opposition as anti-immigrant. The big divide in the Republican Party is there's a populist anti-corporate wing now that is that really motivates the Tea Party faction. And you know, the parts of the bill they don't like are the giveaways to the high tech community. What they see as giveaways to the high tech community in terms of the H-1B program, or the temporary worker program, which they see as giveaways to big business. And so I think that is the That is the sort of buzzsaw that this legislation hit as it moved from the Senate to the House. And of course, the House is where the center of power is now in the Republican Party, and all of the energy in the Republican Party is this Tea Party faction that is based in the House. And you know, just look at the story of Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio, who thought that this was the issue that was going to help him be the leading presidential candidate on the Republican side in 2016, his poll numbers completely collapsed among conservatives. He stopped talking about immigration reform completely, and he quickly looked for a new issue, and he glommed on to the defund Obamacare issue as soon as he possibly could after immigration turned into basically a failure for him. And I think that's been the basic dynamic of this legislation on the right side. It just on the right side of the aisle, it sort of ran into the buzzsaw of the civil war that is happening right now in the Republican Party. And the latest manifestation of that, of course, was, as Fawn pointed out, the shutdown and the shutdown showdown. So I don't really see any prospects for this legislation as long as the House of Representatives is the way it is right now. You have a collective action problem in the Republican Party. Individual Republicans know that passing immigration reform is in the best interest long term for the party, but individual House members, while they might think it would be really great if we could elect a president in 2016, their own personal votes and actions are not. They don't have the incentive to support comprehensive immigration reform because of the way that the House is constructed. The fact that, as Haley Barbour pointed out, they're much more concerned about getting someone getting to the right of them in a primary rather than worrying about a Democrat in a general election. And so that's where I think things are right now.
Would anybody on the panel like to challenge that view?
I don't think I want to challenge that view, but I do want to give some people a sort of counterfactual to think about. And what if the president had not decided to do Obamacare as the first thing he did? Because two things might have happened. One is immigration reform might have been able to be pursued when Democrats had a majority in the House. And secondly, even if that were not true, the 2010 election would have been completely different. So while we suffer with wherever we're going with Obamacare now, these kinds of decisions, these grand political decisions of what to do, have long-term political consequences. So we definitely have the kind of Congress that that Ryan was describing, in which there is a rump group of Republicans who are going to be very difficult to move on this issue, and whether they will only be moved if Republican leadership decides they have to do a deal with the Democrats, and Democrats think that that's worth doing. But these things have flowed from choices that have been made at the highest levels about what our priorities are.
Bruce, let me ask you to talk a little further about that from the standpoint, again, of how employers and business express their interests and engage in this issue. Because this same party, these same people also represent employers and business interests around the country. And it seems that business has become more broadly active in this debate than in 2006, 2007, or I may be wrong about that, but definitely this effort made by the high tech community under the rubric of Mark Zuckerberg and the big amounts of money, et cetera, that we hear reported have been put into this. How is that working? What's to be shown for that? Is that meaningful?
Well, there's huge amounts of money being spent, and a lot of lobbyists are very happy with this decision. Going back to 2006, even more than maybe 2007. 2007, I think, was a misbegotten effort from the get-go, but 2006 seemed like it was a more viable process, but maybe not so. A lot of immigration activists told the employer community that it was their fault that immigration reform didn't pass in 2006 and 2007, and that they could, that they would never get whatever they perceived as they needed in terms of employment-based immigration reform, unless they got on board and passed legalization. That's basically what they were told, and they went along. Whether they had a choice or not, they went along, and they've been drawn into this process in that way. There are lots of substantive questions underneath that about, you know, what kind of employment-based immigration reform really makes sense for the country. But leaving that aside, there's a mythology there, which is that the current Republican membership of the House is responsive to employers on these kinds of issues, which is not true. I mean, it's partly the anti-corporate issue with the Tea Party. That's absolutely right. But it's even broader than that, because this is a little like Microsoft telling a Republican member that they have to be pro-choice. And, you know, it can be in Microsoft's own home district. They couldn't deliver that product. And while immigration is obviously a mixture of social and economic issues, it is, to most of these conservative Republicans, has a large measure of social issue content. And employers don't have the leverage. There's another problem for employers, and that is, who are they going to be for if the Republican lets them down? Well, maybe some of the high-tech companies will be for Democrats sometimes, but the Chamber of Commerce never met a Democrat that they liked except one that looked an awful lot like a Republican. So the Chamber of Commerce really doesn't have a stick unless they do what they're now talking about maybe doing, which getting embroiled in a lot of Republican primaries, which would be a whole different way of an interest group like the chamber working. But the bottom line here is employers were told they had to do this if they wanted the things they wanted, and it turns out that they can't deliver. And it was known to some before they started that they probably couldn't deliver, but this has played out, and I don't know what the end game is. One last thing I wanted to say about what Ryan said about, and what you said, Doris, about the polling. You know, 90% of the American people wanted background checks, and it didn't pass. So we don't have a majoritarian system. We never have. We never will. The House doesn't work that way. Some people think the House is a majoritarian institution. It has its structural peculiarities as well. And so the polling data tends to mislead people on the grassroots advocacy basis to believe that solves the problem, when it is obviously an important component, but it doesn't solve the problem.
Let me just pop in real fast with an anecdote from, I want to say it was 2006, it might have been 2005, but at one point I quoted Adam Putnam, the Republican from Florida, who was very much in favor of immigration reform, saying that the business community was asleep at the switch during the debate over the enforcement Sensenbrenner bill. And I remember the Chamber of Commerce getting very upset with me and with Adam Putnam for quoting him in that respect. But what it told me is that it's a very convenient excuse for Republicans to blame the business community for not being there to back them up, when in fact, I think, as Bruce adequately puts, there's no way they really can.
I think I want to go back to this question of kind of Ryan's statements and Fawn's statement about whether or not immigration reform as legislation is done or dead. I guess, you know, do the prospects for immigration reform look better or worse? I really do think it depends on the day. And I guess for me, it's my job to believe that we can deliver and that we can do more and that our movement is stronger than it has ever been. It's more diverse. The coalition is bringing in people from all different sectors. And, you know, I think that we have an H.R. 15 bill. We have the House version of the Senate bill. We now have three Republicans who have come out as of yesterday. We have Representative Denham, Representative Valadeo, Representative Roz Lehtinen, who have now jumped onto this bill that has 185 Democrats on it. Now, that might not be the process that moves forward. Because we don't control process and we don't actually know. But, you know, I think a week and a half ago, I woke up and I was like, oh, this is done. And then Mario Diaz-Balart comes out and says, I'm working on a bill. And then Representative Issa comes out and says, I'm working on my bill, and not because I think his bill is great. But that there are different, I think that the Republican Party's confused, in the House, and that they don't really know how to move forward on this issue, and that you have some members, for whom this issue is very important. And we have enough people to get this through the finish line. It's just, of course, a matter of whether or not this is a priority for House Republican leadership. It's a question of what will make them tick and what is there anything strong enough to really push them on this issue. So I wouldn't say, you know, all prospects are done. And I think it's really my job to say that. Like, not my job as in I'm director of advocacy for United We Dream, but my job as in, like, I am coming from the community that has put this issue at the forefront. We have done the building work on the ground. This is not just politics. It's not just legislation. And, you know, and I know this is an academic crowd, but we're talking about real lives. We're talking about real people. We're talking about 1,100 people who get deported every day. And to me, that is the crisis that we find ourselves in at this moment. Now, Republicans and Democrats may not want to recognize that right now, may not decide to act on it. Right. And I said something wrong because I think everyone recognizes that is the crisis and that the status quo is no longer acceptable. It's just a question of whether or not I think House Republican leadership will get courage enough to move this issue forward.
I think that a little historical item that would be useful to demonstrate that if a minority of a party feels strongly enough that something should be done that the leadership of that party doesn't want done, there are mechanisms in the House to do it. In 1981, President Reagan passed his budget in the House of Representatives over the objection of the Democratic leadership and the Democratic majority by a procedural matter of taking control of the House floor during a rule vote. And that rule hasn't changed since 1981 and could be done. And it required, you know, Phil Gramm and others like him, who was a Democrat at that time, to take a group of so-called boll weevil Democrats and have them vote against the leadership and with the president.
But Bruce, this is the difference in American politics between 1981 and 2013, there were things called boll weevil. Let me finish. There were these boll weevils, and Ronald Reagan won dozens of districts that were represented by Democrats. The number of districts in the House right now that Barack Obama carried out of 435, Obama carried 17.
You mean of the Republican seat?
Districts that Republicans won that Barack Obama also won. So his leverage in the House is, you know, theoretically it's 17 seats that he should have some leverage over. Ronald Reagan, what was the equivalent number? It was literally dozens.
It wasn't as big. It was very big after 84. It wasn't quite as big after 80 as that would suggest. But your point is well taken. Just let me just say that.
And the fact that Phil Gramm became a Republican sort of tells you the story.
The reason he became I can tell you why he became a Republican. It didn't happen then. It happened after we kicked him off the Budget Committee when I became a member in 82. But that's a different story.
The larger point is just that things are much more polarized. The parties are much more homogenous.
We agree about that. But the point is that thinking that you're going to sort of change the Tea Party behavior is mistaken. The only way they're not going to change their view.
Yeah.
And they're going to block any rule that puts a bill on the floor.
Yeah.
Because they have the power to do that unless the rule is a bipartisan rule. And all I'm saying is that take 17 and take 200 Democrats and add 17, and at the moment that's a majority. You need 218 when one of the seats is filled. But the point is that those 17 or 20 or 30 who are actually Republicans who would be politically benefited by moving immigration reform would have to stand up and make this a big enough issue to do what those boll weevil Democrats did.
Yeah.
Okay? And all I'm saying is – if one is trying to move this short of another election, that's the kind of commitment that's required. It's not the intellectual commitment. It's not even the co-sponsoring of a Democratic bill. It is the willingness to say to Boehner, you can go ahead and punish me and take me off the committees or whatever you're going to be doing, but this is important enough to me. This issue doesn't have that salience with respect to most of the members, Republican or Democrat, certainly those 17 to 30.
Or to even, I mean, not just most of the members, but just even 20 members that would sign a discharge petition. I mean, that's basically what you...
No, it's not actually a discharge petition.
Okay, but, could you get 20 to do it? I mean...
But this is not a discharge petition strategy. This is a separate parliamentary procedure.
Okay, but either way, could you? I'm sorry.
No, I wanted to turn to you because I go ahead. But I wanted particularly to draw you out on this point that if it comes out in the way that this panel is talking about, that is very much the way you would like to see it come out. So part of my question is that. Does that meet your goals in terms of your constituency?
Is that the end game?
or are there aspects of the immigration issue, broadly construed, where you would actually like to see legislation, or is the position that you take that nothing legislatively should be done, and it's a prevention action?
Yeah, thanks for that question. Well, I mean, first of all, as the bio. May points out, we started an organization to carry out the recommendations of the bipartisan U.S. Commission on Immigration Reform. So we're an immigration reform organization. We are not in the business of trying to stop things. We're trying to pass immigration reform. And the key aspects of immigration reform are that you, number one, place the top emphasis in immigration policy on the most vulnerable members of our society. So that's the foundation of what we want. Secondly, that you look to see what is needed, truly needed, for the economic purposes of the country, the employers, but not for the employer's sake, but for the sake of the people of the country. So the recommendations, I believe, are just as valid today as they were then. When President Clinton appointed Barbara Jordan, we had a great economy. And even then, they said 1 million green cards a year, lifetime work permits, were a fundamental a tool of economic injustice because of loosening the labor market. So the recommendations and I'll quickly say this, the recommendations of the Jordan Commission were cut legal immigration in half, do away with chain migration, which has nothing to do with any economic need because people come in without regard to jobs or skills or education. There's nothing wrong with the extended family. It's just that it's not necessary. You do that with visitor visas. People can visit each other, and it's fine. Secondly, is that you do away with the lottery, and you have a verification system that as Bruce says, we put almost no stress on the border at all because why fool with the border when you have this gigantic help wanted sign through the business community? So, what could happen now? Well, the trouble is that the Senate bill is almost the opposite. It's like every detail is the opposite of immigration reform. This year, stopping everything is our goal. But at this point, because of the abject failure of so many administrations and of Congress to deal with these recommendations, we have millions of people in this country who have been allowed to not just live here, but to work here. And, of course, we totally disagree with the governor. We don't believe any of those jobs require immigrant workers. But they've been allowed here to work here so long that we've got these entangled families. We've got people like the Dreamers, who I've said for years have absolutely compelling cases for an amnesty. So the problem I see for the people whose primary purpose is to achieve an amnesty is that they've gone to bed with the corporate chiefs who have insisted on not just work permits for 11 million who are here illegally, But adding 20 million more, now 10 million would come under the current system. But we believe that probably at some point, we don't necessarily believe it. As we would hope at some point that the country would come back, or I should say Washington, would come back to its senses, look at the true elements of reform, do what's best for the most vulnerable in this society, provide business only what it absolutely needs, and deal with the people who have been here so long as they have compelling cases for an amnesty. But that's not going to happen this year. It's not going to happen next year. I don't know when it'll happen.
Okay, well, let me, there are a lot of things we could talk about from the standpoint of what the Jordan Commission was envisioning and not, and we have expertise on that here, but I'm going to try to bring this to a close so that we can turn to the audience for questions. But I want to do that with a final question to you, Ryan. I mean, you've heard Lorella talk about, in a very different way, about what this means to the people she represents and many, many other people in this country. But what you're both talking about, you and Fawn, in particular, also Bruce, would lead to the conclusion that not only would something not happen in this Congress, it might also not happen in 2015. What are the big stakes here? What if this continues to stall? What does it mean for American politics?
So, I mean, a lot depends on the midterm elections, I suppose. The prospects, if nothing happens this year or next year, then the prospects for 2015 would be dependent on how the 2014 midterm elections played out. Mm-hmm. If Barack Obama somehow took back the House, pretty good chance you'd get reform. I mean, our system basically works under the current polarization when one party controls everything. I mean, if you look out in the states right now, and look, the country is basically moving in two different directions. You have a historically high number of states that have one-party control. The governor and the legislature are controlled by one party. And in those states, look at like Kansas under Brownback. They're passing restrictions on abortion. They're cracking down on illegal immigration. They're not cooperating with the ACA. They're not setting up exchanges. They're not taking the Medicaid money. They're moving to the right. Look at a state like California under one-party control under the Democrats. It is passing all sorts, or Colorado. I was in Colorado recently. You have Governor Hickenlooper there with a Democratic legislature, which is passing liberal immigration legislation. The public has legalized marijuana. He passed some pretty liberal gun control. So if you want immigration reform, the best way to get it is for Democrats to take over the House and retain the Senate. 2009, 2010 was an incredibly productive Congress because the Democrats controlled everything, and for a lot of it, they had a supermajority in the Senate. So that's the best scenario for 2015 from the perspective of someone who wants comprehensive immigration reform. Long term, I think the political dynamics of this issue are pretty obvious. That we all know what is that the fastest growing groups in this country are Asian Americans, which are actually growing faster than Hispanics and Hispanics. And I maybe just close with in the short term, Republicans inspired by the Tea Party are going to block this legislation. And I honestly don't see that changing. I don't see their position in the House changing in the short term. In the long term, this will be a policy victory for folks like Lorella, for people who want to see comprehensive immigration reform, even if it's not this year or next year. I was in Texas the last week of the election last year, and I walked into the Republican Party of Texas's headquarters and sat down. And Texas is a very unique state because it is a majority-minority state now. And you know, I walked into the Texas Republican Party headquarters and looked up on the wall, and it had all of the statewide offices that were held by Republicans. Every single statewide office in Texas is held by a Republican, and they're all white. It's the only state in the majority-minority state in the country that is completely controlled by white Republicans. I mean, that's an anomaly in our politics. And I walked into the leader of the Republican Party's office, and he sat me down, and he said, he started to tell the story about how the Republican Party in Texas is on the verge of collapse. I said, I just saw in your office, you guys control everything. And he took me through a PowerPoint presentation about how the demographics of Texas are changing so fast, and they have to increase, Republican statewide candidates have to increase their share of the white vote by such a dramatic measure every election cycle that by 2020, it's game over, unless his party starts wooing Hispanic voters. And as you all know, if Republicans can't win Texas as a presidential level, they can never win the White House. And of all people during that reporting trip, Ted Cruz made the exact same point to me. So at some point, this policy, comprehensive immigration reform, will meet the demographic realities that will force the Republican Party into a position that the RNC and the head of the Texas Republican Party and others are advocating. And the only question is when is that going to happen? But I think prospects of that happening in the next year or so don't seem so great right now.
I just think there's one caveat that has to be given to that, that the politics of the House, and that is the districting structure of the House and the control of that process every 10 years at the state level, means that while it's all, that change already has occurred in the presidency and the Senate, it has not occurred in the House, and it's an open question whether it happens in the House in 2020 or 2030.
Yeah.
And so all that you said is correct, but I don't think the people that Lorella is talking about, much less the parents of the people that Lorella is talking about, can wait till 2030 for that dynamic. And I would just suggest that people who want this change should be thinking about the interim elections, where the change of 20 or 30 seats can change this politics in Washington, even if the overall House doesn't change in quite the same way.
Yeah, I completely agree. The House is a massive break on that change. Just one quick stat before we wrap up. After the redistricting in 2010, the average Republican House district, this is, became 2 percentage points more white. So as the entire country and the demographic story in the entire country is a more diverse country with rising numbers of Hispanics, Asian Americans, and other non-whites, the average House Republican represents a district that is more white. So.
All right. We've teed up a lot of issues very, very effectively. I want to thank everybody. We have about 15 minutes for questions from the floor, 12 minutes maybe. So please raise your hands, and the mic will come to you. Let me see if I can see a hand way up here on the right.
Thank you, Doris. Michael Daugherty. The Senate bill that passed this year is about 40% larger than the last great bipartisan effort in 2007. So it's around 1,139 pages long. I think the Kyle Kennedy bill was somewhere around 744 pages. We thought then that was a very big bill to negotiate. I'd like the panel's perspective on, is it always going to be true that a bill is quote-unquote comprehensive, or is there a true possibility of negotiating something where there's a quid pro quo on finite, understandable objectives for both sides of the issue coming out of Congress?
Fawn, why don't you take that?
That's a really good question, and I remember I once had an editor who did not want me ever to put the page count for a bill because it's meaningless in a lot of ways. But the question of comprehensive versus not is really a false dichotomy. As it turns out, the way the Senate bill was, this last one and the one in 2007 was negotiated, each of the individual components of it were individually negotiated, and so this last year, when we thought that the Gang of Eight's bill in the Senate was ready to go, it turned out that the agriculture piece was still being heavily negotiated between the unions and some of the unions and the worker representatives and the employers. I didn't even know about it because I was focusing on the big picture. So I think when people talk about comprehensive, that means something different. And it's taken on this, in the immigration context, it's taken on this idea of anything that's comprehensive includes some form of legalization and probably citizenship for the 11 million who are here in an undocumented status. But the thing that I have been most perplexed by is the sense that, for whatever reason, the House's idea of taking up each individual issue piece by piece is somehow less of an action than the Senate acting on this big 1,100-page bill. They're doing exactly the same thing. They're trying to make each piece easier for their members to handle on an individual basis. And then the other thing politically that they're trying to do is they're trying to make it be possible that if you are a Republican member who is not adamantly opposed but probably would be happy if the issue just went away, that you can go ahead and say maybe you can vote for the Kids Act, which is the Dream Act equivalent that Eric Cantor is working on. Maybe you can vote for that, but maybe you don't have to vote for a broader legalization plan. Or if you are in an agriculture district in Florida, the issues can come up and you can vote for an agriculture bill, but you don't necessarily have to vote for a big guest worker bill. And so there's all these calculations that are going on, but my feeling is no matter what, they're coping with all the issues in the same way that they did in the Senate and the same way they did in 2007. So it's just, if the House does anything, if they start to move forward on anything, to me, that's just as good as working on a comprehensive bill. And sometimes I don't know that people understand that. Sometimes I think advocates get upset if they see that the House is going to do just a smaller piece. But really, the question is, and I think Roy has made this very clear, if the House doesn't do anything, that's what they would prefer. If the House does something, then that means that you're moving forward in a way that everybody from the Gang of Eight in the Senate to the Gang of Seven in the House would want to be going. Well, now there's five. Anyway, that's my view on that.
Okay, other hands. I see one over here on the left.
Hi, I'm Jeff Carter with the Council for State Directors of Adult Education. And I just want to follow up on your point, Fawn. Very well taken point. Part of the comprehensive Senate bill that I was most interested in was the integration piece, which I understand got in there kind of at the last minute. Was my concern, and I guess my question for the entire panel is, what do you think the chances are that with a piecemeal approach, we'll get something around immigrant integration along the lines of what we saw in the Senate bill?
I don't actually know the answer to that question, but I do think it's important. I mean, it's the thing that has actually worked very well in terms of bringing along moderate Republicans and some of the more conservatives in terms of helping them to see this more as an integration piece. But I don't know that it is being negotiated. The only piece of legislation where I can see that happening is in a path to legal status bill that is perhaps going to be unveiled at some point in the future. But the one thing, even if it's not sent in the House, it will be part of any negotiations with the Senate. So my guess is that no one will object to including it. And if they ever get to that point.
Bruce, do you want to add?
Yeah, I want to sort of pile on with what Fawn said earlier, which is that the definition of what's acceptable procedurally can be a reason that nothing gets done as well as what you prefer gets done. And on that, along with tens, if not 20s or 30s of small ideas about improving the immigration system, they aren't all that controversial as items that could be passed by the Congress. But we are in an environment in which the only thing that can pass the Congress is comprehensive immigration reform, not anything else. It is appropriate that we deal with the 11 million and the Dreamers and that problem, because we have to deal with it. It makes no sense not to deal with it. I even hear Roy saying that after a fashion. So if we dealt with that, then a whole lot of other things, much like 1986 led to 1990, a whole lot of other things would be much less controversial and much more subject to negotiation than they seem to be today, when they're all bargaining chips over the legalization question. So in my view, I've always thought legalization is the log in the road. It's the log that stands across the road of making our immigration system better and more sensible for the long run. And obviously, if you're going to do legalization, you have to do prevention on the other side so that we're not just going to do this again. That could be the project. That could be the only project. And what would you say to the business people who want more visas? You would say later, next, or whatever you want to say, but this is the nation's priority to deal with the problem that we've all created and that we all need to solve, and then you could move forward. I think if advocates looked at it that way, maybe we'd make, I mean, it wouldn't be any easier with the Tea Party, although we'd take away the sort of corporate giveaway part. It might not be any easier, but it would be a lot clearer to the American people, and it might get done.
Interesting. Okay, I'm just looking for other hands. I've got the lights in my eyes, so it's a little hard. Here, okay.
Hi, my name is Kathleen Smith. I'm a recent graduate of Villanova University. My question is related to a statement that Mr. Morrison said about that the border is kind of irrelevant if we don't enforce or do prevention in the work site. So I was just wondering, you had also gone on to say that some in this debate don't seem to understand the importance of prevention in the worksite, and I was wondering if maybe they aren't talking about it because they're afraid of alienating some of their business donors and who give them, you know, fund their campaigns or are their constituents, or is it simply more of a lack of understanding of how enforcement is tied to the worksite?
I've been working on this worksite issue for too long, so I won't go into all the details of it. The sides have changed over time. There was a time that employers were much more resistant. But there is resistance to employment authorization systems because it's a great imposition on the 95% of people who are legal and authorized to work in order to find out who the 5% are. So there is a lot of resistance to that, that comes as kind of a civil libertarian reaction politically. And the current system that we have is completely ineffective against identity theft. So if we just did what's in the Legal Workforce Act, for instance, or what's in the Senate bill, we would have the same problem we had after 1986 that sooner or later would be undermined. So there's a whole nother project there. I think people have basically accepted that if there's going to be legalization, there has to be a worksite scheme. And there's lots more that comes with the worksite scheme, which is off the books employment and treating people as independent contractors and all the kind of employers who don't comply with any rule today, like wages and hours. So that it's not like simple, but it's clear what you have to do. It's hard. I think if we were focused on that as the counterpoint to legalization with that clarity, we could drive through something that would be a lot better than when it's all mushed up with 1,200 pages or whatever they are.
Other hands?
Doris, just a point on Bruce's thing. It's very interesting that in the previous Congress, Speaker Boehner blocked the Verify bill. I mean, it's the same thing was happening then. There was a chance to actually be moving on cutting off the jobs magnet, not and with something much, much stronger that dealt with identity theft than what has been passed the Judiciary Committee. And that was a case where most of the major corporate lobbies were in favor of that. They endorsed it. But in the end, there were a couple that didn't. And there were some people who got Speaker Boehner's ear in terms of they wanted amnesty for their agriculture workers. Everything came to a halt. So this kind of deadlock, we were on the other side trying to push something through that year, and the same kind of deadlock stopped that too. So it's very difficult to seem like if you work on something too small, and that was, I guess, too small, that doesn't go through. If you work on something too large, like CIR, that doesn't go through. I'm thinking that Bruce may be onto something, the idea of, it's got to be something a little more comprehensive than one bill. You've got to be linking some things, but you can't do too much at once.
I think you need three components. You need a enforcement component. You need some type of legalization, and you need to deal with ag.
Not to solve everything, but to solve something.
Right.
But I think, first of all, I wish that we could, that someone would pick up on the idea that this, that prevention is the goal of Americans, not enforcement per se. That Americans want to prevent this from happening again. They are not in favor of ham-handed enforcement. And everybody insists on saying enforcement, and I think words matter. Yeah. I think we do better if we talk about prevention. But the problem, Roy, is that what Romney got wrong when he talked about attrition is what the Legal Workforce Act, that is E-Verify, mandatory E-Verify, standing by itself is. That is, you can't impose mandatory worksite and then not deal with who the people who are going to come to work, even as new employees changing jobs, and be illegal, and then be faced with what do you do about that. And we already have a little bit of that in our current system, and we get it a lot more. And so if you're for that, you have to be for what you're going to do about the 11 million. Those are tied together. But and ag is just a microcosm of that question. So it's not really separate. It's just one of those where it's separate in political ways, but substantively it's the same thing. That is, you have an illegal workforce, and if you're going to impose some kind of worksite verification, you're going to have to deal with that illegal status.
Okay, I want to close this by asking Lorella a final question, and that is that we're ending this on a pretty pessimistic note, in case anybody noticed. And so I want to ask you, Lorella, if what has been the consensus here comes to pass over the next year and possibly a couple of years, what do you see happening in your community and in the pro-reform advocacy community in general?
So I don't feel very comfortable talking about what everyone is going to be doing, but I think I can speak to what United We Dream will be doing, what Dreamers around the country will be focused on. I think for us, being at the table and talking about immigration reform, I think people around the room have a sense of what our priorities are, right? Family reunification, because too many families have been ripped apart and separated. Making sure that there's a pathway to citizenship so that we're not creating a permanent second-class status. Making sure that there's a strong dream title. I think if there was no real prospects for, if we ended up without immigration reform in the next year or two, then I think that we go back to the basics. And that is, looking at things from the perspective of what is the fuel to our movement. And the fuel to our movement is really the pain of our community. It's really the fact that 400,000 people get deported every year. And I don't think we will, I know for a fact that we won't stop working to make sure that members of our community are ripped apart from their families and their communities. And that might not mean a legislative solution. It might mean looking at other types of administrative relief options. So we are committed until the end, until we find a way to stop that pain in our community. And, you know, I think we can have a whole separate discussion about administrative reforms and administrative relief. But for us, the goal is to stop the deportations from happening.
Okay, and there will be discussion this afternoon on exactly some of those issues. So this actually is a very good segue. I want to thank the panelists for a really, really stimulating, far-ranging conversation. And I want to invite all of you in the audience to take a 10-minute break and then be back for our next panel. Thank you all so much.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.